Hey guys, it's Steve. What you're about to listen to is a live podcast that we recorded at Otherworlds Austin a couple of weeks ago. We are very excited to present it to you. It went out live on audio and video during the festival, and we were able to talk about two great movies, one of which was screening at the festival. We're happy to present it to you guys now, more or less unabridged and unfiltered. The sound quality is not up to my exacting standards because we recorded it directly off of Zoom, but it is totally listenable and enjoyable, and so we hope you guys enjoy it and join us for this discussion from Otherworlds Film Festival. Thank you.
Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science versus Fiction.
Oh, and welcome to another special episode of Science versus Fiction. My name is Scott Weinberg. I am a seasoned veteran film critic and fan of science fiction. And I am joined by my co-host, Dr. Steven DeGennaro, who will tell you his credentials right now.
Hi, I am Dr. Steven DeGennaro, and I am a former astrophysicist, a recovering astrophysicist, and I know the science, and currently a filmmaker. So there you go.
There you go. And we are here to discuss two very different films based on the same source material. And I had a good time revisiting both of these films. Steven, why don't you introduce our hosts and tell us what we're doing here on this special episode?
Well, yeah, thank you very much to Bears and the entire Otherworlds team for having us back. Last year we did Time After Time, which was very, very fun. We did a live in-theater experience. That was our first time doing a live podcast and with a studio audience, and we had so much fun doing it, and they asked us to come back, and so we're very happy to be back here. Thank you, Bears. Thank you to the festival for having us back to talk about this year's headline repertory screening, which is, drumroll please, Judge Dredd, starring Sylvester Stallone.
Yes, and Dredd, starring Carl Urban, both based on the character Judge Dredd, who was originally introduced in the British sci-fi anthology book 2000 AD, and then spun off into his own book and wildly popular breakout hit from that series of books. And I want to read some of this stuff. Like when I got into Hellboy, I went back and, you know, read a lot of the old stuff and had a ball reading the original Hellboy stuff. And having rewatched these two movies, I want to dig into like the best Dredd stories. I want to read some of them now.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be frank. I'm not really much of a comic book / graphic novel sort of person. But I can, I can definitely see why people like this character and these stories. So, by the way, just as a doctor, I need to inform you, Scott, that the mask doesn't really work properly if it's not covering your nose.
Oh, sorry. Just wanted to plug my mom's been making these masks. You see Jack Skellington all over there. So I thought that was cute. So what's interesting is that if you had asked me a week ago what I thought of Judge Dredd, the 1995 adaptation, it is technically a Disney production. It was produced by Hollywood Pictures or Touchstone, one of the other two, and they're subsidiaries of Disney. It's got a pretty good cast. Rob Schneider, I think for the first half of the movie, pretty personable as the sidekick. As the film goes on, he gets a little bit more shrill and annoying. But I was not a fan of the guy in general. I'm just trying to be fair. I think for the first half of the movie, he does a really reasonable job of being the comic relief sidekick. Diane Lane, great in a relatively thankless love interest role. Max von Sydow great in a couple of scenes. And in my opinion, the best in the entire film, Armand Assante as the nefarious villain / half-brother, kind of.
Don't forget Jürgen Prochnow.
Jürgen Prochnow is great. And it's got a fairly decent setup. It sets up, the distant future and wherein the world is a scorched earth landscape, and populations have gravitated towards these giant mega cities. And it's just basically what it sounds like. Imagine like a city the size of Baltimore, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and that area combined is one large city. I guess that's the that's the premise. It's
which, you know makes me wonder, point of science, how these people feed themselves. Like that, like the premise, at least as I understood it in both of the movies, is that there's just this big city because everything else is an irradiated wasteland, and but you can't really grow food to feed that many people in a city that size unless you have a similarly large or much much larger agrarable, that's not the right word, but that, you know, the farmable area in order to grow food for all those people. So that's
right. One of my first thoughts. Well, in the first film, it's kind of unaddressed. But in the second film, I think there's a clear implication that there is full-scale cannibalism afoot. Like, it's an industry. That's why they're carting all the bodies off.
Is that what the recycling is meant to?
Yeah.
Regardless, that's not sustainable ultimately, right? That's
no.
For every person, you know, when somebody dies, their meat is going to be inefficiently turned into future people. But eventually that, you know, you're going to lose a little bit every time you try to recycle a person by feeding.
Right. Well, that's what they say. It's what he says to him at the end is, you know, we're just the beginning and the end of the slaughterhouse. But I think it's made clear in the books that there's the cannibalism is not only afoot, but an industry unto itself. But I guess that, again, it does take place in a world that is not sustainable, which is part of the fantasy, part of the fun fantasy of the dark fantasy of the story. But it's also a social commentary on maybe we're not real far from this.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, let's back up a second. I definitely want to get into the social commentary of this and how that has aged into the current era, because I think it's interesting and fascinating. So as you were saying, this takes place in a future world where we live in these mega cities, and the judges, which obviously Judge Dredd is one of them, this is sort of a combined police force / legal system that is entirely self-contained. And so the judges have the authority under the law, in this world, that they can go and they can, if they find somebody committing a crime or have adjudicated somebody on the spot as being guilty of something, they can punish them however the law says is appropriate, up to and including executing them on the spot. I think one of the issues that I have with both of these movies, just on a world building sort of thing. Well, not a world building sort of thing. This is external to the movie. So maybe let's talk about the internal. Let's talk about the movie itself first. We'll talk about the science. And then I definitely want to get in a little bit into the sort of the social commentary that both of these movies get into and whether they succeed at it or not.
What I like most about the character, and again, I know very little about it, but just based on mostly the second film and a little bit in the first, is that I think that the story is meant to be the world is 98%, fascist and automatic and completely autocratic. Thank you. That's the word I meant. And that even Dredd, who is a huge part of that machine, still has these little progressive or regressive human touches, that he will occasionally break his protocol to do something that is right and then keep going in his fascist way.
Well, what was so interesting to me, it felt a lot like a couple of movies that we've covered so far, Logan's Run being one of them, Minority Report being one of them, Blade Runner to an extent.
It's the entire, cog in the machine, and now the machine is coming after me.
Exactly. And now I realize that the machine is fascist because now I'm actually being targeted by it. And that it's a fascinating idea, obviously. It's a setup that's ripe for drama. But at the same time, I don't feel like either of these movies grapples with that really in any meaningful way. And some of that might just be this is 2020 and it's the year of defund the police and George Floyd and our politics have progressed and changed a lot since either of these movies are made. But the second one especially, the first one, I from what I understand, the original character, the comic book, there's a lot of very, very dark humor and satire involved in it. And I feel like the Stallone one did a really good job of, of having that sort of tone of keeping the satirical tone. It's definitely a lot more lighthearted. The second one is very darkly comic, but I think the second one
might be more in tune again. And I feel like we're both dummies for kind of trying to pick from the source material and neither of us have read it, but based on the research or the reading that I've done, the dark, dark humor of the second one is much more likely to be found in the book than, because I think the first one is, hey, we're going to take something that's cult popular and then take cult popular and gloss over it with very mainstream action. And so let's just focus first on the original film or the first adaptation. Yep. What were your thoughts on it going in? Had you ever seen it before?
I had never seen it before. I had never seen either of these movies before, and I had never seen that one.
Cool.
In my brain for decades, that movie has just been very, very closely associated with the other Stallone dystopian future police movie that came out almost around the exact same time, Demolition Man.
Yeah.
And which I did see Demolition Man way back in the 90s, but for some reason I'd never seen this one and always just kind of assumed that it was more of the same thing. And it is in a lot of ways. I mean, this movie, it's so 90s, like from the score, the production design, the costuming, it's very
90s.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where like, it's only through doing this podcast and watching some of these 90s movies that we've been watching that I really start to feel the disaster movies in particular, like Volcano and Independence
Dante's
Day.
Peak.
Yeah, Dante's Peak, and that like that there is a feel to 90s movies, and it's one of those things where obviously everybody knows that the 80s has a thing, right? 80s has a feel, and it's very it's the nostalgia for it is now extremely popular. But I never really sort of thought of the 90s as having a style, as having, especially, on the filmmaking side of things. But when you watch a bunch of 90s movies in a row, these big budget studio action movies in particular, just in terms of the camera movement, in terms of the cinematography, like I said, in terms of the music, in terms of the production design, obviously, and the actors involved, they do have a feel. They have a very, very specific sort of feel to them.
Now I want to know, just off the top of your head before you get into it more, as you were watching it, were you eye rolling and groaning, or were you like, this is more fun than I thought? Which one?
It's fun. I mean, whatever. It's, obviously it's not a movie that I'm going to, it's not a movie that won any Oscars, let's put it that way. Even back when Oscars still went to movies like this occasionally. Although I think it might've been nominated for several.
I don't have a real high tolerance for this kind of disposable action movie. I could see them once, maybe twice, and then just never think about them again. Occasionally, I'll go back to something like Cliffhanger, which I love. I'll come back to that more than once. And this I had seen once, didn't care for it, kind of forgot about it. Obviously, rewatched it for the show and was impressed by a few things. One, it moves pretty quick. It's under 100 minutes, and a lot of it is very conventional. Like, you get the beats. He's being betrayed, so the villain wants to do away with the judges, and he gets got to get rid of Judge Dredd first so you can put your plan in motion, and it's all perfectly serviceable and conventional, but I was impressed by it, that it moves kind of boom, boom, boom. If this movie was made today, it would be 140 minutes long.
Yeah, well, I mean, this movie was made, well, not today, but recently. And
good point. This version,
But this version, it does, I don't want to say suffer from, but it certainly feels, you can tell its comic book roots, and this is obviously pre Nolan's Batman. It's very comic booky, and, that's a double-edged sword. It's fun in that comic booky way that 80s and 90s comic book movies were. It didn't ever try for any sort of gritty realism or anything like that.
It doesn't take itself super seriously. Sorry to cut you off. I thought you were tailing off there.
No.
But you made me think of an interesting point, is that it's not a comedy, but it also kind of has a cocked eyebrow.
It is. I mean, it's got Rob Schneider in it. Okay.
So, yeah. Like, and he's the comic relief, but it's generally a stone face kind of action, you know, very serious.
It is, but there's still the one liners. I mean, like all every 90s movies, it wasn't even necessarily make a thing of comedy, but like I wrote several of them down, especially towards the end of the movie. They kind of got into this quippy thing. Like at one point, somebody calls Diane Lane a bitch and she goes, "That's judge bitch to you," or something like that. And he's at one point he says, "I'll be the judge of that." And at another point, at the very end, I think when he kills Armand Asante, he goes, "Court's adjourned," which is very, very 90s, just in terms of that, the quippy, you know, Schwarzenegger Stallone sort of.
I was also a bit impressed, and I think you might be as well. What did you think of the general production design, the matte shots, the just the visual?
I forget sometimes how good visual effects were. Even that early, because I think of, you know, I think we've talked about this before, but like, you know, Terminator 2 was 91, 92. And, you know, just the digital effects were completely groundbreaking at that point. But by 1995, when this came out, when shortly before, like Starship Troopers came out in 97, like CGI had matured a lot by that point. And so there are some shots in this that look better than some. There are a couple of shots in the 2012 version that stick out to me as being bad digital stuff that looks worse than some of the stuff in the Stallone version, for sure.
Yeah, there are some establishing shots and some matte shots and some, you know, miniatures, and that look solid. And there are lots of movies from this era that look, you know, that don't hold up, you know, the effects do not hold up. Yeah. And I think that the plot is just your generally conventional. He's our hero. He's betrayed by somebody within the system. He has to fight back against his own kind and save the day. And, you know, everything's solved with the defeating of the one villain. So the plot, you know, doesn't really do much for me. There's not a lot of meat on those bones, but I will say that I didn't eye roll my way through this revisit. And a lot of times when I revisit old action movies, I kind of roll my eyes a lot. And this was
it's fun. Really, it's a fun movie. I mean, like, you know, it's a fun movie to watch. It's fun. Speaking of the production design, one of the things that jumped out at me, the anytime they were in sort of the city, in the downtown area of the city, not like the slum area, but like just in the sort of city, there's a part where they walk through a place that looks kind of vaguely sort of futuristic Chinatown-y, and it looks, I mean, it's lifted almost wholesale from Blade Runner. It looks like they just shot it on Blade Runner's set. Like,
I thought you were going to say it was lifted wholesale from Super Mario Brothers.
There's a little of that as well.
Yeah, that's the 90s, like the urban decay look that was so prevalent in the 90s, where everything looked like there's pipes everywhere and broken cinder blocks and fires inside of
neon signs and
big buckets.
I mean, again, I think all of that owes a huge debt to Blade Runner in particular. I think Blade Runner influenced every, you know, so many movies for the next couple decades in terms of that type of futuristic production design. Then it's very much on display in this. I do love a lot of the design of like the big wall, and when they go outside the wall and encounter Herschel from The Walking Dead as a cannibal.
Also a very young Ewan Bremner, not even recognizable, but I watched the credits and I didn't even know he had broken out in that era, 95, 96, but Ewan Bremner is one of those mutants.
Speaking of credits, for some reason, there's a very young James Remar who is not credited.
Yeah. In the prologue.
But anyway, one of the things that like struck me in that sequence in particular, like I was saying earlier about sort of its comic book roots, it definitely felt a little episodic at points. Like it felt like, okay, let's take some of our favorite moments from a comic A and comic B and comic C, and again, not being familiar with the comics, I don't necessarily know which things are sort of iconic. Like, is this big robot thing like a thing from the comics that they felt they had to include?
Yeah, I love that. The design of that thing is so, it's one of the things that I legitimately like. There's half of this movie I don't like and half I legitimately do. And that the design and creation of that robot is fantastic.
I loved the cannibal guy that's sort of half robot cyborg. He's got the thing in his forehead. That whole sequence I really, really liked at the same time as recognizing, okay, this feels like an episode of
it feels like five or six vignettes. Here's the story where he gets sent to prison but gets shot down on the way, you know. I want to cover two things that annoyed me and I think annoyed the fans. And then I want to get into a few more things that I like. Is that cool?
Yeah, yeah. And obviously we got to, you know, we got to move on to the science.
Yeah, yeah. Two things that happen in this movie that shouldn't, according to, if you're going to be loyal to the book. And obviously any movie fan knows that you do not have to translate a book, but you should maintain some the form. Spirit. Yes, yes, right. So in this movie, Judge Dredd takes off his helmet frequently and extensively. That's a no-no. And it's because in this era, you're not going to make a movie with Stallone and ask him to cover his face for the whole movie. Just not going to happen. Yeah. And two...
In any era, really.
Yeah, he has kind of a love interest in Diane Lane. And that is also a big fat no-no. I know that both from the books and both things in the movie don't fit. They just don't fit. Like the idea that he might have a tertiary romance with Diane Lane's character not only doesn't matter, it's not interesting, you know? So,
yeah, I don't know that I entirely agree with that. I forgot how smoking hot Diane Lane was.
She still is, but like, always but been.
When she was 30, yeah.
Remarkably so, beautiful. Like,
yep. I, you know, I'm perfectly willing to go along with Stallone, you know, having, you know, Stallone, I feel like the only person Stallone has ever had actual on-screen chemistry with, as far as love interest goes, is Talia Shire.
Yeah.
And that's such a unique sort of weird chemistry but it's hard to imagine Stallone falling in love with anybody in any movie except for that one. So in that sense, like, they were kind of a little bit doomed from the start. The way they structured the story, I don't think there was any way they were going to not have to have his helmet off. They may have been able to leave it on more than they did, but he gets put on trial and in prison and whatever else, and so then he's not going to have the helmet on.
Well, my research indicates that in the multi-decade run in the books, he never takes off his helmet, or when he does, his face is never shown. It's only in shadow. So, you know, cool. Yeah. Props to Carl Urban. We're going to move on to that movie in a second, but there is a science question I wanted to ask you, Stephen.
Yep.
Is there a weapon that could house both a normal bullet and a hand grenade?
There are literally weapons that exist that have that are rifles.
Yeah, but this gun didn't seem physically capable of holding the ammunition that shooting.
This is even less of a science question than just a basic, like, I don't know, logic question. Because, yeah, we can all see that gun. We can all see the size of that gun. We all have a sense, roughly, of how many bullets that thing could possibly hold. And even if you were to say, okay, well, the grenades are just the size of normal bullets because they have some sort of futuristic high explosive that they don't need like a full grenade. They can have like a little bullet. Even under like the number of bullets that he in both of these movies that he fires out of that gun is a little sort of ridiculous. It is one of those things where and I presume this must come from the comic because it's in both of the movies that, you know, he shouts out what kind of bullet he wants it to shoot and it'll shoot that kind of bullet. He's got explosive bullets and he's got like double bullets and he's got what else? he's got a bunch of different kinds of bullets.
But why wouldn't you just use the strongest ammunition every time?
Well, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. Well, ask me that question again when we're talking about the other movie, because the other movie, I think, makes better use of the different kinds of bullets that he has. There are a couple places in here, like when he shoots the double bullet, I think a two-shot or a double shot or whatever he calls it, and he shoots two bad guys at once. That's kind of interesting. But again, like, you can, like, given that there seem to be 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, I don't know, different types of bullets that this thing is capable of shooting, you would have it room at most for like one of each in that gun, maybe. Even if they were, again, if they were the size of normal bullets, you could have one regular bullet and one explosive bullet and one double shot bullet and or maybe 4 or 5, you know. But instead, obviously, they're sitting there just shooting those things left and right. Speaking of the guns, one of the other pieces of technology that, again, I assume must come from the comic book because it's in both of these, is the fact that gun is only shootable by the owner.
I believe the word you're looking for is wieldable.
It is only wieldable. Well, I know you can wield it. You just can't.
No. Yeah. Good point.
Shoot with it.
I'm sorry.
I remember now. I think in Dread, in the second movie, it only explodes when somebody tries to shoot it. In the first one, I think when he just picks it up, it electrocutes him.
No, when he tries to fight.
So that's a technology that we are already developing, that it, not developing, that it exists. It does not use DNA like it in the world of Dread. It actually can read your handprint and will only shoot if the correct handprint. Same with, you know, the thumb reader that, that you open your phone with. In this world, it reads your DNA, which I mean, again, even in the future, it's hard to imagine a DNA sequencing program that's fast enough that you can pick up the gun and it can know within microseconds that your DNA is your DNA. But, you know, I guess it's in the future. That's another thing about this, in terms of world building, that's sort of a little sort of weird and wonky, is that there's a lot of this futuristic technology, even though it is kind of supposed to be a dystopia that, you know, the world kind of collapsed.
Right. Where's the corporation making these guns?
Right. Exactly. Like, you know, in something like RoboCop, which I think this is also owes a debt to, you know, the, you know who the corporation are. You understand how, you know, that corporate world fits in with the law enforcement world. And this is just that when they have a bunch of advanced technology, even at the same time as they have these slums and they have these. But as far as the guns go, the thing that jumped out at me, and it wasn't until I was thinking about it later on, but one of the main plot points is that, you know, he gets framed for murder. And the way that they frame him for murder, so there's two things in this. The way that they frame him for murder is they use his gun. And his gun can only be used by him. And so, okay, well, it must be his gun. And not only that, but they explain in painstaking detail how the gun when it fires a bullet, it takes his DNA and it codes his DNA onto the bullet.
Yes.
And then when the bullet kills somebody, so they can actually track that that bullet was shot by his gun because it has his DNA on it. But these are the judge's guns, right?
Yeah.
And these are a group of
people. The lawgiver.
Explicitly, right. It's called the lawgiver. These are a group of people who are explicitly authorized by the state to execute people if they adjudicate them guilty on the spot. They have a literal license to kill. Why would you ever need to track those people's guns for unauthorized killing? And the gun can't be used by anybody else.
Well, but I mean,
why would you have this technology on that gun in the first place?
Because in theory, if a crooked judge was just out here shooting people willy-nilly, then you could prove it.
But why would, if you thought that that was a possibility, then you wouldn't have this system at all, because this system is clearly built so that it's fascist. It's built in such a way that those police officers can literally just go and do that with impunity. And in fact, again, in the second movie, that comes even more to the forefront, because they actually show what crooked judges look like.
Well, let's switch over to the second movie, because
we got all of the science points out of this one.
My only science questions to you were involving the gun and, you know, the sociological question or anthropological question of, if there was a massive disaster of a nuclear type of any kind, is this kind of what would happen? Would people gravitate towards the cities as close as they could get and then sprawl outwards?
Honestly, because the most likely places to have been destroyed and irradiated are those cities. I mean, like, they're not, you know, like, it's almost the exact opposite of what you would imagine would happen, because it's not like if we had a nuclear war, Russia or China would bomb, you know, Poughkeepsie or Topeka. I mean, they might, you know.
Right.
I mean,
you would think you would have a better chance of living a long life in the middle of Kansas than you would near what New York City used to be.
Right. In the middle of rural Kansas specifically. But I can guarantee you, if we ever get into the kind of a nuclear war that this is predicated on, New York, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Boston, all of the cities that you name are going to be glass and, you know, uninhabitable for.
Thank you for not saying Philadelphia.
So, Philadelphia. And, yeah.
But, you know, obviously you're not an expert in this field, but you would say that probably not. People would not just, I mean, I get the symbolic metaphor. It's kind of a Romero thing, which is that in the time of disaster, people gravitate towards what they know. And what they know is they want to be near a big city that has stores and restaurants and people and convenience. So I guess that's part of the social commentary.
Yeah. As far as science stuff goes, you know, aside from some little nitpicky stuff, and maybe some people will ask us about that, the only other thing that really jumped out at me about this was, it's fun, foundational to the story, is this idea that he and Armand Desante It's confusing to me, honestly, and maybe you know the answer to this question. Nope. Because it's definitely
that's like that whole section of the movie is hazy for me.
The idea is that they created Stallone in a lab, basically. Yep. From a bunch of other judges, from all the best qualities of a bunch of other judges, and then sort of Danny DeVito in Twins style somehow or another, like Amara DeSante got
now there's a second one
genes, but again the story is predicated in this idea that his DNA got encoded in the bullet that killed these people that he got framed for, because Armand DeSante killed them. But if they have identical DNA, they should look alike. They should it's confusing because it keeps trying to say that they're brothers or that their DNA. I mean, either this society is not good enough to tell two different brothers' DNA from one another when they would only share 50% of their DNA, roughly, or Armand DeSante has identical DNA to Sylvester Stallone and yet
but looks different,
entirely different,
and he's shorter,
has a different personality, and is also described as genetically the worst person in the world.
Far as this movie is concerned, he is the best person in the world, because of everybody in this movie he is the one given scenery to chew, and he is the one who gets the tone, I think, of like he's not wildly over the top. He is over the top, but within the limits of this kind of dark sci-fi story.
And both of these movies had great villains.
I know. I was going to say that's two things both movies have in common: great villains and great musical scores.
Yes, very different. Very, very different.
This bombastic
score in this. Yeah, it's so 90s.
Alan Silvestri, mid 90s, very heroic score. It almost doesn't even fit the movie. You would almost want something a little bit darker. But it
feels like it's from a Star Trek movie.
Yeah, but it is still beautiful. It's a beautiful score. It's maybe a bit incongruous, but I love the music in Judge Dredd.
I think it very much works. It's very much, again, that's one of those elements that feels of the era sort of very perfectly. Aside from the octagonal hallway, which every science fiction movie has decided that in the future hallways are going to be hexagonal or octagonal instead of just regular squares.
I like triangular hallways.
It's just one of those things, one of those science fiction things that just every science fiction movie feels like it does this if it's sufficiently far in the future. The other question about those clones, by the way, so that Armand DeSante is trying to create an army of clones of himself, the bad version of him, as opposed to the good version that is Sylvester Stallone, which is whatever all the other judges think that they're going to be creating. And towards the climax of the movie, he creates this army of them, but he's in trouble, so he needs their help now. So he asks the computer to just release them, and they said, oh, well, they're only 60% complete. And he goes, I don't care, just release them. And these kind of zombified, like white, slimy
things. That's not what would pour out.
Right, it's not what they would look like. And they show up, there's like two shots of them, and then they blow up the facility and they're never seen again. And it makes me wonder if there was a sequence that got cut out that had those things in them, because they introduce them, they make them an element in this thing, they go out of their way to show them bursting out of their coffins, and then Stallone or Armand DeSante like destroys the whole facility, and then that's it. And I thought I missed something. I literally had to rewind it like three times to figure out, and I think maybe I did. I think maybe there was something that was supposed to have been there that didn't make the final cut, but I could be wrong about that. Maybe one of our viewers will know the answer to that one.
But switch.
We've talked a little bit about it, but we can move on officially to 2012's Dredd. He dropped his first name or his honorific in this, as a doctor, I who doesn't use my doctor honorific very often, I can understand that impulse.
This is Carl Urban stepping into the helmet and doing, in my opinion, a fantastic job of playing this kind of character who is 90% robotic, but then human or humane in a very tough, realistic, pragmatic way when things call for it. And I think he nails, again, I know very, very little about the source material, but it seems like this is what the character is supposed to be.
Yeah, we talked about this, you and I, yesterday a little bit. The the first movie begins with this opening text that's narrated by James Earl Jones, which makes me wonder how much they paid him to come in and just narrate this opening text. And they show the text on the screen and James Earl Jones narrates it. And you and I were talking about how, like, you could never get away with that in a movie. Like, that was a staple of a lot of science fiction movies, because they just, like, you know what, we want to get to the story. We don't want to spend 15 minutes world building.
Another thing stolen from Blade Runner.
So we're just going to tell everybody what it is, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I noticed, because we had talked about that when I then watched Dredd, it begins more or less the same way. It just doesn't have the text on the screen. It begins with Carl Urban doing the narration about what the world is and how we got to where we are. But it's over stuff that's much more visually interesting than just a bunch of text on the screen. We actually see shots of it, and we see the city, and we're following along with it. And it made me think that there are still a lot of movies that begin that way. They just don't. I mean, even like if you look at Blade Runner, well, I guess Blade Runner 2049 does the actual text on screen, because it's, you know, a sequel to the original. But in this case, you know, they wisely got rid of the text on the screen, but they, again, just dispense with, like, we don't want to waste a whole bunch of time trying to catch you up on this world in a way that's less expository. So let's just tell you what the world, you know, here's the situation, here's the recap so far.
I generally don't like the text crawl. Not in all cases, but like, it's for the reason you said. If you are going to open your movie with some expository narration about, like, what happened to the world that you're setting in, where we have to give you some big picture information in a very short period of time, so we're going to have a character tell you. That's fine. We don't need the text. If it's interesting and the person telling it is compelling, we'll listen and get it. Yeah. Oh, we get the world. It's post-apocalyptic, and most of the world lives in these horrible, overcrowded cities. Right. And within these cities are these giant, giant blocks, skyscraper towers that are just basically prison.
Hundreds of stories and you know. That's one of the cool things I liked about the world building in the second movie, is that the high rise. Because, you know, this, I hadn't seen this one either. And the only things I really knew about it, besides Carl Urban, was the high rise thing. And so I was expecting something kind of like High Rise or kind of like The Raid, and didn't really sort of get a sense until I watched the movie of the scale of this high rise, which is like every single floor of this thing is, you know, multiple city blocks. And it's got 100 floors on it. And so, like, the scale of the number of people that are inside these things, it's the size of a small city, population density wise, and probably surface area, you know, land area wise. So this movie, you know, it contains it entirely in that setting, that Dredd is, in this case, has a rookie who also happens to be a psychic, who is his new partner, or who he's evaluating for the day to see if she is worthy of being added to the judge corps. And they go to investigate what seems like a routine murder, triple homicide, which is unfortunately routine in this world, and accidentally uncover a giant drug operation and criminal enterprise.
Let me just throw in real quick why I think, writing wise, why this movie is more interesting than the first one. The first one is basically a vehicle for Stallone. All right, it's fair enough. It's fine enough in that regard. What's interesting here is that Dredd is almost the secondary character. Anderson is the hero. She is the character who is in a moral gray area. Right. We don't know if she's going to be consumed by this system, or if she's going to strike out on her own and be independent and think for herself. And he is kind of guiding her through this world and the audience through the world. So he is the dominant character, but in a lot of ways, she's the protagonist.
Yes. No, I felt that watching the movie as well. Obviously it's named after him, but like I said, she's the one who arcs. It really does feel like her story much more than it is his story. He's great. I think they made all the right choices as far as him and his character.
Olivia Thirlby. I think, you know, there's so many ways for, like, the precocious newbie rookie to be, like, overly cocky or too flustered and inept. Yep. And she's perfect balance. She's a fantastic character, a really good performance.
Yeah, exactly. And she's kind of the beating heart of the movie. The other beating heart of this movie, the black beating heart of this movie is
Lena Headey.
Cersei Lannister, Lena Headey, doing a disorienting but spot on American accent. Her and Donald Gleason both were very weird to see either of them do American accents at first. Both of their performances are spectacular.
I think what's so great about her is not just that she is obviously, let's just say it, uglied up. She's a beautiful woman, and she is scarred with rotten teeth and bad hair, and she never has a moment. Well, there are a few flashbacks where she looks normal, but it's not just, oh, look, I'm a pretty woman or a pretty actor going ugly. Right. That's the character. The character is not one of those villains who gets what they want and then claps their hands. This is a miserable person. This is not a happy villain who's like, I'm going to get my plan underway and do. Yeah. No, this is somebody who is at a bad point in their life and they don't like what they're doing, but that's who they are. That's where they're at.
And then she's given just enough in the writing, you know, to feel some amount of sympathy for her character.
Empathy, if so. Empathy. Different, you know, like you feel bad that she put herself in that situation, but then once she got there, she's a villain of her own accord.
But she's you know, she's a badass in and scary, honestly.
Like unhinged, like the kind of villain where you don't know, she might just blow somebody away for no reason, or just she's unpredictable.
And in the hands of a lesser actor, you could see that performance trending more towards the Armand Desante sort of thing, which is again not a knock but that fits in that movie.
It is not showy and theatrical. She is quietly disturbing.
So science-wise, one of my favorite things about this, which is the only other thing I knew about this movie going into it, was this this new designer drug that the movie is centered around, which is called Slow-Mo, which makes for some really, really amazing visual shots at several points in the film. But the premise of it is that it subjectively slows time down to a crawl. And I find that idea, the sort of... it exists at the nexus of scientific and philosophical that I think is cool as hell. I think
it's like fascinating. It's, you said visually a dozen times in this movie where they show off the effects of this drug are thematically and dramatically interesting. What is even more interesting is what it does to you and like the impact that it has on some kills later in the movie. For example, I mean, not to, we could get cut to the end or whatever, but if you're on a drug that makes a moment seem like 2 hours,
right,
and somebody throws you off a building while you're on this drug, you're in a kind of torturous hell for hours on your way down.
So what's yes. But at the same time, when that happens early on in the movie, I would imagine if you were a kind of person who was literally out to torture somebody, literally torturing them while they are on this drug, and every, you know, like you could torture them for 10 seconds and it feels like 10 hours. And I can't imagine that physically torturing somebody for that length of time when there's nothing that they can do about it. I find the idea fascinating, right? Because what it really amounts to, because when you're on the slow-mo, it's not like you can act faster, right? So you think of things like Quicksilver and a lot of those the sequences that they do with him in some of the X-Men and Marvel movies, where like the world is slow but he's still able to navigate through it at a normal speed. Like if you get on slow-mo, you're still like, you know, if you decide to raise your hand is still going to only go up at the speed that it would go
relative
up
to you, right?
Right. Well, not relative to you. Like, point is, that feels just as slow as anything else. So really what it is doing is it's speeding up your thought process to the point where you have more thoughts per second or per millisecond than you did before. And you can actually, I don't know, time is one of those things that, again, is at this nexus of scientific and philosophical, because it's a thing that scientifically we don't really have a very good understanding of what the heck time even is.
It's something we created.
Right. And why is time? So there are four dimensions in our universe. There's three dimensions of space and there's a dimension of time, and time is different than the other three dimensions for reasons that we can't understand. I can move left, right, up, down, forward, backwards in space freely, but I can only move in one direction in time. And it's really only my consciousness that makes the passage of time seem like a thing. And consciousness, like just in our regular lives, like I remember when my son was born and we were in the hospital, how time just completely slowed to like a crawl. And I remember specifically the nurse coming in on like day two of us being in the hospital. So he was born around midnight and then we had a day in the hospital and maybe the morning of the next day, the nurse asked a question about him or something like that. And both my wife and I were both like, oh no, he's never done that in his life. But wait, his life has only been 36 hours at this point.
Right.
And yet it felt like we had had him for like a year. And just that.
It's also
that,
the opposite goes when you're like playing a video game that you really like. And you're like, oh, I'll play for an hour at 5 p.m. And the next thing you know, it's literally 1 a.m. And you're like, I was not just playing for 8 hours. Yes, you were.
Yep. Or when you're writing or when you're in the zone and you're doing something that is that absorbing. And I think it's fascinating, the idea of making a drug that could alter your perception of time. I mean, there are drugs that do that now. I mean, there are hallucinogenics that will mess around with your sense of all of your spatial perceptions and including your temporal perception.
I'm on three of them right now.
But the idea of manipulating, like deliberately manipulating it so that you experience the world slower. Like I can see how that kind of a thing would become massively addictive almost immediately, just because it's just such a fascinating idea. And just the idea of like, okay, well, everything is going way slower now. And like my life is 10 times longer now because I'm on this slow motion, even though I can't accomplish more than I would have otherwise.
Ooh, let's
experience of it. I don't know. It's fascinating.
Let's wrap up what we think about. Let's cover Dread because we want to, if you want to open the floor to cute questions, I'm going to say right now, I'll just cut right to the chase. I love this movie. I think it is a ridiculously badass sci-fi action movie. I could watch it once a year. I think the score is great. I think it's cut to the bone. There's not a wasted frame in it.
Yep.
It knows exactly what it wants to be and is exactly what it wants to be. I just love it. I think it's, I love the premise. And I love that people compare it to The Raid because they do have kind of coincidental premises and that, you know, you got to get out of this high rise and right. There are thousands of criminals ready to stop you. I think there's plenty of room for that premise for two movies.
well, especially because, again, they do it in such radically different ways. I love this movie, too. I thought it was really, really good. Like I said, yesterday was my first time ever watching it, and I was entertained the entire way through.
Did you ever get that moment when you were like 10, 15 minutes in where you were like, ooh, I'm going to like this one.
I was from the opening couple of shots. I was
that motorcycle chase is fantastic.
Well, so that was what I was talking about. Partly that, I mean, it is an interesting chase, but at the same time, there were some egregiously bad green screen shots or possibly rear projection shots in that opening sequence that of the guys in the car as they're being chased that just like immediately stood out to me, especially after watching the other movie. But my nitpicks with this movie, speaking of the slow-mo thing, I do like this idea of how they used it in that opening kill. I was expecting at some point for the slow-mo thing to become a plot point in a way, like the mechanism of it, like he takes slow-mo and it enables him to like kill a bunch of bad guys that he wouldn't have otherwise been able to do so, or he has to fight somebody who is on the slow-mo and therefore can react faster than him because they have 10 seconds to think about what they're going to do next instead of 0.01 seconds. I was a little disappointed that never came to pass in the movie at all. Like I was expecting, because maybe it's because, you know, that I played this video game, the sequel, spiritual sequel to GoldenEye on N64, is this movie called, or this game called Perfect Dark. And one of the things in that is you can take this sort of like stim pack that slows things down, and you still only move at the same speed. You know, you're moving slowly as well, but because you have a lot more time to think about it and a lot more time to aim yourself exactly right, like you have an advantage over the other people in the AI people in the moments where you take that thing, because you're essentially just thinking a whole lot faster than anybody else. And I was disappointed that it didn't ever go there, but I guess it's in one sense doesn't make a whole lot of sense to hold a movie accountable for a thing that you wanted it to be instead of what it was. But on the other side, to do it again, I think both of these movies, and especially this one, I don't know that this movie understands that Dredd is not a good guy. right? Like that this world is not a good world, that he is an agent of a corrupt and awful system.
Well, I mean, it's like you mentioned earlier, it's just dark satire. I mean, in the joke of this movie, he's Dirty Harry, you know, he's the hero.
But the point is he is still the hero. And like, again, I think maybe it's because it's 2020. Like I have lost my taste a little bit for movies where, you know, the cop is, because he's a good guy, because he's a noble person who has good intentions, the fact that he is propping up a horrendous system that, in this movie in particular, it criminalizes drug addiction, it criminalizes poverty. Like there's a point where they walk into the thing and they tell this guy, if you're here when we come out, we're going to arrest you and throw you in jail for 2 years for vagrancy. And then and later on in the movie, it kills that guy. The movie decides to kill that guy in a very brutal sort of way. And I don't feel like the movie wrestles at all with the idea of, okay, well, you know, whereas the first movie, at least like he sort of recognizes over the course of this that he's part of a corrupt system. Whereas I don't think the Dread in this movie ever really wrestles with that.
I think the bigger picture is that even as badass and tough as Dredd is, he's still a tiny cog in this giant machine. And the ongoing chestnut is that he will maintain a small semblance of humanity in this inhumane world.
I guess if you examine it from her point of view, from her being the protagonist, like, you know, she walks away from the system, right?
Yep.
And it's a little open-ended at the end as to whether or not, you know, because partly it's her saying that she assumes that she's not going to pass. But she also says, basically, I don't care if I pass or not. I don't want it. Like, I don't want to be a part of this system.
It's such an interesting ending to me to have the character just walk away and choose to. I think, like, in no other action film do you have that ending. She's going to stay, and then she gets shot in the belly trying to save Dredd,
right?
Or she becomes a cop, and then they flash forward to her winning 30 awards because she's brought some more humanity to the system. Or I think it's really interesting that the movie has her quit.
Speaking of getting shot in the gut, there was the other scientific nitpick I had in here. At one point he gets shot with this armor piercing bullet and it goes in, you know, he's got his back to a wall. The bullet goes through the wall. It goes into him and comes out his front. And then after he, you know, manages to extricate himself from that situation, he seals the front wound with some sort of goop and then these little staples, these little futuristic staple things. And he dresses the front of the exit wound, but he never at any point does anything to the entry wound that's in his back.
Right. Plus, isn't there stuff inside that might need to be repaired?
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, clearly it didn't go through anything that was going to immediately kill him. But, you know, where it was, it probably would have gone through his liver.
Yeah, but
you would kill you right away. But,
you and I know well know from covering so many action movies that it's not even a nitpick to say, oh, you know, that would put him down, because in every single action movie, like, Stallone gets punched in the face 6 times. I don't care how tough you are. If you got punched in the face 6 times, you're not getting up. But in an action movie, they do it all the time. Yeah.
So we've got a couple questions here, it looks like, or a question from our buddy Dan Jaff. He asks... Oh, wait, this might be from Bears. Why do you think fanboys care more about Dredd taking his helmet off than the look and feel of the comic, which is lost when you are stuck inside a building?
Ooh, that's a good question. That would probably be better to somebody who has read the books. Because, yeah, I mean, I love the, you know, stuck in the high-rise complex of this movie. But if you've read a lot of the comic and you know, you were kind of hoping for some of that outside world, I could see how this would be disappointing.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it comes down to that adaptation sort of thing, right? Which is, whereas the first movie felt like it was like, okay, well, let's throw all of the comics into a blender and pick all of our favorite moments from various different comics and kind of construct a story out of that. This movie decided, I think, to be faithful more to the spirit of the comics. And in doing so said, okay, well, how do we translate that to a cinematic experience? And I think that that's what they, you know, were aiming for. David Jaff asked us, what do we think of the 3D in Dredd? And I, especially since you and I have made a 3D movie, I haven't seen it in 3D. I didn't see it in the theater. I only was able to see it on iTunes.
I did see it in the theater. So. I don't believe I saw it in 3D. And I have no, I don't feel like I missed anything. Sorry, David.
I bet those slow-mo sequences were probably really cool.
It's so beautifully shot, man. It is this, there's like, that's what's really one of the most interesting things about this movie, is that it has these quiet little isolated moments of visual beauty, and then they're punctuated by something just disturbing, sickening, violent, crazy, over the top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't see any other questions in here, but I'm not 100% sure that the chat is coming through in real time for me. I think a bunch of stuff appeared well after I was, I think it was typed based on the timestamps. So are you seeing anything in the chat?
It was a question about what did you think about the production design, A versus B?
Oh, I haven't seen that. That didn't pop up in my chat for some reason. What did you think about the production design? Again, I think it's just a difference in eras, right? The first movie is comic book, right? Right down to the sort of like almost Spirit Halloween quality helmet that he's wearing throughout most of the movie. It's very comic booky. It's very chintzy. And I don't... Sorry, one sec. I'm sneezing there. I don't mean that in a bad way. I think that's just the aesthetic that they're going for. I think the production design in both of them was great. I think it's... You know, I prefer the second one because I think it's more modern. But I think for their eras, I think they both succeeded in what they were.
Right. So overall, I think we both agree that Dredd is awesome. Judge Dredd is a little better than its reputation or memory might suggest.
And I would definitely suggest everybody watch it tonight at Otherworlds, for sure. I think it's a very, very fun movie. I think it continues a tradition that Otherworlds have of putting on these very, very fun repertory screenings. They've had The Black Hole. They've had Battle Beyond the Stars. Last year, we did Time After Time and Dreamscape. Most of which were movies I hadn't seen prior to Alien Nation, which I had seen. This is yet another in the long line of great screenings that Otherworlds has put together on the repertory side. So,
and thank you, Otherworlds, for inviting us back for a second year. We love doing podcasts. We love doing festivals and anything that is specifically dedicated to sci-fi. And Bears and the team are always great. So thank you. Thank you for inviting us back.
And thank you guys for tuning in and for listening and for asking questions.